Ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of the Hagmann Report. Doug Hagmann, Joe Hagmann, heard right here on Global Star Radio Network and Blog Talk Radio, BTR, the fine folks there. Click follow, by the way. And we also have 5 hours of programming each day, 3 hours of our flagship show, and an hour for the Doug Hagmann Radio Show, and an hour for John and Joe for the Hagmann Daily Show. Tune in. That's I'm 9 to 10. And you guys are starting something new, Joe. You're starting...
Yeah, tomorrow... And from tomorrow moving forward, we're going to be live on Blog Talk Radio at noon. And part of that is going to include live audience interactions. We want to take calls each and every day. And we hope people line up tomorrow at noon. The call-in number is, I'm going to put it out on, I'm going to write up, do a little write-up, put it on Hagmann Report. I'm going to put it out there on social media.
Okay.
But from now on, the shows will be live at noon, and you guys can call in.
That's pretty
and,
cool.
Yeah, it'll be more That's interactive. Great.
All right. Well, I want to mention out of the gate that tonight's program brought to you by Omaha Steaks. Oh, if you are looking to find that person that's so hard to buy for this holiday season, have we got the great gift for you, or even as a business gift to a colleague, a friend, hey, your parents, whatever. As a matter of fact, Omaha Steaks, go to omahasteaks.com, and when you get there, type in HH in the search bar. What'll come up are specials for only the Hagmann listeners, and I've got to tell you, they've got this great family gift pack that's 75% off. It's under $50. More on that later. That's omahasteaks.com, HH in the search bar. Go there for sure. But, yeah, it's, so the new programming tomorrow, beginning with you tomorrow. Now, tomorrow I'm going to be, delving deep into some, aspects, some very curious aspects of the deep state war against Donald Trump. Make sure you tune into that, because I've got some things based on my research and investigation that I don't think many people thought about, but I do believe. And just to recap things, and we're going to get, I think we're going to get the input from Bill Federer this hour on the indictment. You know, Mueller was, the sole purpose of Mueller is to impeach, not indict, but to impeach Donald Trump. And I think that he's well on his way to do so. Now, what will happen at that point? I do suspect that the left is gonna, you saw how they reacted to the fake news of Brian Ross and that the vile, vicious glee from people like Joy Behar. It was just, who celebrates the takedown? Who would celebrate?
Well, it'd be one thing if Donald Trump was, you know, committing treason against the United States, or there was an actual crime that he committed against, you know, the people of this country, right, or against the duties of his office. But that's, I mean, they were already fishing and grasping at straws to begin
with. It's pure hatred.
It's driven by evil.
Yeah, and I think, and I really believe this, and I think repetition is necessary. You may get tired of hearing it, but I think it's important to really reinforce our points that it seems very clear to me now that nobody within the government expected Donald Trump to pull off a victory. He did. Certainly not Hillary Clinton. She didn't even have a concession speech written up. And Doug Weed, who's a historian, I'm a fan of Doug Weed, his work with five presidents, I believe it is now. Excellent, a great guy, a very personable guy. In fact, I met him in Washington. About 20 years ago, and you see, in fact, I had him sign one of his books. But nonetheless, I think what we're seeing now, from a historical perspective, and from a deep state shadow government perspective, is the takedown of our republic. That's the intended goal here. If we can't have it, no one's going to have it. We're going to burn it to the ground, and that's what's taking place. So the minutia is important and how things are playing out. And I think one thing that was said this past weekend, the Department of Justice and the FBI was ruined under Barack Hussein Obama. Now, I'm not talking about the rank and file members of the FBI or even at the Department of Justice. I'm talking about the higher echelons. The DOJ and FBI were actually ruined under Obama. They were politicized, weaponized for political purposes. And I had mentioned too about a list is there a list of people that are targets of the shadow government via the Department of Justice, via the FBI? Yes, there is. And it, this was true under Obama. Whether it's true right now or not, I think elements of the remaining holdovers are working on this list. Now, on top on this list, of course, aside from Donald Trump, is Donald Trump Jr. and, of course, Jared Kushner. So I think that we're going to see more come up. But in the at the end of the day, I do believe, and I'm starting to see some cracks in the veneer that's shielding Hillary Clinton and Huma Abedin. Will this lead to any kind of investigation? There is an OIG investigation of the FBI and DOJ, as I mentioned before. But will that lead into more of an investigation into Hillary, the Hillary servers? One thing I want to mention is Tom Fitton from Judicial Watch has done a great job with respect to his legal actions against the Department of Justice, against the FBI, even under Sessions. And it surprises me because he said that even under Sessions, even during a Trump administration, they are getting so much blowback, or they're getting so much resistance to turning over information, even under this Trump administration. So what's that all about? And that just reflects, in my view, the holdovers and holdouts, and the really the effectiveness of the shadow government that's in place. The last thing I want to mention too about Tom Fitton. By the way, for Attorney General, you don't need to be an attorney to be Attorney General of the United States. That's not in the job description. I'm not sure if there ever was not one historically, but you don't need, that's not part of the job description. But we need a more effective Attorney General, in my view. I don't know, what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. Jeff Sessions is useless, in my opinion, as Attorney, you know, from recusing himself from every and any case that he is asked to look into. He's really one of the reasons behind this whole Mueller mess, and we do need a very strong leader who's not afraid of what people think or public opinion, and I think that is one of Sessions' downfalls, is that he is somebody who cares about what the people think and is afraid to do his job because of that. We have with us our guest, our debut guest, Mr. Bill Federer. And he's got an awesome bio. He's an author who has written over 20 books, including George Washington Carver, His Life and Faith in His Own Words, America's God and Country, Encyclopedia of Quotations, to this one sounds very interesting, Three Secular Reasons Why America Should Be Under God and What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam in the United States. His recent books, American Minute, and America's God and Country, Encyclopedia of Quotations, are excellent reads and would make thoughtful, fantastic holiday gifts. Mr. Federer, welcome to the Hagman Report.
It's an honor to be with you tonight.
Well, the honor is all ours. We love history. We love the historical context of current events. And if we can, let's start there, if you don't mind. We're living in some very interesting times, aren't we?
Well, we are, and one of the talks I give, I start off with a digitized picture, and you're so zoomed in, all you see is the pixels, and I ask the audience, what are you looking at? And well, you can't tell them until you click zoom out. Sometimes all we know is the day-to-day headlines, and we can't tell what we're looking at until we zoom out and look at some history. One of the books that I put together this last year is called Who is the King in America? It's actually an overview of all the world's history and how the most common form of government is a king. So writing was invented around 3,000 or 4,000 BC, a Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets. And from that time till now, the records show the most common form of government is a king, a pharaoh, Caesar, Kaiser, Sultan, Tsar. And if you've ever seen a Nautilus shell that does the little circle, little bigger circle, little bigger, bigger circle, that's called the Fibonacci sequence, or a ratio of geometric expansion called the golden ratio. But if you plot out these world empires, you see they go from small to bigger to bigger. And you have Gilgamesh, king of Uruk, and then Sargon of Akkadia, 2250 BC, conquers from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean. and then 2,000 years of Egyptian pharaohs, and then Assyria had the largest empire in the world around 700 BC, and then the Babylonians conquered them, and then Cyrus of Persia had the biggest empire until it was conquered by Alexander the Great, then conquered by the Romans, then conquered by Attila the Hun. You keep going forward, Genghis Khan conquers from Korea to Hungary in the 1200s. He has the largest contiguous land empire. And then you get to the maritime empires of Spain and France and ultimately England. So the King of England was like a globalist. He controlled 13 million square miles, 500 million people, all of India, a quarter of the world's population right there. And when America's founders got the chance, they wanted to flip it and make the people the king. This was a total anomaly on the planet. It wouldn't have happened without some unique things of a 3,000-mile ocean and so forth. But America's founders were experimenting in letting the people rule themselves. They did look back to the Roman Republic, and which lasted until Julius Caesar found a way to usurp power and make himself a dictator. They did look back to the Athenian democracy and until Alexander the Great's dad, Alexander Philip of Macedon, found out that he could bribe citizens of Athens with money under the table and they would betray their own city. But ultimately, the founders looked back to ancient Israel. So around 1400 BC is when Israel comes out of Egypt. For 400 years, they do not have a king. This is literally the first instance in recorded human history of a nation with millions of people and no king. And it worked for 400 years as long as the priests taught the system. And when they didn't, the rubber band snapped back and they got King Saul, who turned around and killed most of the priests. But America's founders looked back to these examples and they strove and they did sort of a hybrid to give us this form of government where we, the people, get to be in charge of our fate. So a republic is where the people are king, ruling through representatives. And when we pledge allegiance to the flag and to the republic for which it stands, we're basically pledging allegiance to us being in charge of ourselves, right? And so when somebody protests the flag, what they're effectively saying is, I don't want to be the king anymore. I protest this system where I get to participate in ruling. Well, guess what? If you're not involved, somebody else will determine the fate of your life. Well, that's the general gist of the book. But in the back of it, I go through how democracies and republics fall and how dictators end up usurping power. And that has some application for today, if you would like me to get into that.
Please.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's very relevant to today. And one of the things we've done on this show is, look at the similarities, specifically from the fall of Rome, the Republic of Rome, and how that fell, and the similarities between what we see happen there versus what's happening in America today. But yeah.
And I just want to add one thing. I would urge everyone, if you're interested in a very well-written, very well-articulated book, Who is the King in America and Who are the Counselors to the King? This was published just at the beginning of the year. Bill Federer is the author, and it's doing great on Amazon. It has got a lot of great reviews. So think of your Christmas gift. This is a great stocking stuffer by William Federer. As a matter of fact, that's going on my list for my wife. I'm going to tell her I want that book. And Bill, if I can wrestle you for a signed copy, that would be even better. But having said that, go ahead, please, continue.
Well, 500 years ago, Italy was not Italy. Italy was a bunch of city-states. Venice, Genoa, Naples, Florence, Siena. And they all had armies and navies and fought. And so a guy named Machiavelli thought if one prince could control all of Italy, it would stop the infighting between these noblemen's republics. And so Machiavelli wrote the book called The Prince, where he advocated the ends justifies the means. The end of one prince controlling all of Italy is such a good end that any means necessary to get there is justified. Why? Cheap steal. So if a prince conquers a city, the people would hate him. But if the prince ahead of time paid criminals to kill cows and burn barns and create crisis and domestic disturbances, the people would cry out for help. The prince would come in and dispatch the very people that he bribed to cause the crisis in the first place, and everyone would praise the prince as a hero. So it's good marketing. You create the need and fill it. You go around the back of the house and set it on fire, and then you go around the front of the house and sell them a fire extinguisher, and they'll pay anything for it and thank you for being there. So it's called Machiavellianism, where you create or capitalize on Christ. That was 500 years ago, and lots of politicians have studied Machiavelli, one being Hegel. So in the early 1800s, Germany was not Germany. It was a bunch of provinces, Saxony, Bavaria, Prussia, and they had armies and fought. And Frederick of Prussia wanted to unite them, and so his philosopher was George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. And he did take on Machiavelli, but he sort of made an equation out of it. And it's called Hegelian dialectics. And if you can imagine a triangle, one corner is the thesis, the opposite corner is an antithesis or antithesis, and the top corner is a synthesis. It sounds complicated, but it's not. In other words, you start off at the first corner, then you create the antithesis. You create a crisis that's real bad, and then everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad, the synthesis. That becomes the new thesis, and then you create another problem that's real bad, and everybody's happy to settle for your answer that's half as bad. You do this over and over again until the people give up their freedoms and powers reconcentrated back into the hands of a king. And so Karl Marx took this, and how do you create an antithesis? Well, you send in agent provocateurs, provoking agents, community organizers, labor organizers. Their job? Find people with grievances that you can stir up until there's rioting and bloodshed and lawlessness, and then everybody will surrender their freedoms to someone who promises to restore order. But when they do, the dust settles, and you've just returned back to a king. And so 45 countries have fell to communist dictators this way. And so they would send in their organizers and organize the proletariat against the bourgeois, which is the working class against the business owners. They'd organize the blacks against the whites, the Catholics against the Protestants, the Hutus against the Tutsis in the Congo and Rwanda. They really don't care who the two sides are, and they really don't care what the issues are. Their goal is the destabilizing domestic crises. Sort of the David Horowitz quote, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. And so they really don't care about, flags and Confederate statues or whatever. Their goal is a destabilizing crisis. Well, so now we've talked about Machiavelli. We've talked about Hegel. And the next is Saul Alinsky. Now, who is he? Saul Alinsky rode around with Al Capone's hitmen in Chicago and saw how all you had to do was kill a few people, smash a few windows, and the whole neighborhood would submit to the mob and pay extortion protection money. And so he applied this to politics, where you create really bad crises. And so Hillary Clinton did her senior thesis at Wellesley College on Saul Alinsky. And President Obama was a Saul Alinsky community organizer there in Chicago. So what did Saul Alinsky say? He said a community organizer's job is to rub raw the resentments of the people of the community, fan the flames of hostility to the point of overt expression. The community organizer must seek out controversy rather than avoid it, for unless there is controversy, the people are not motivated enough to act. So this is the politics that has been being played out in America. It's the intentional creating of crises so that there can be a destabilization, and then when the lawlessness gets out of control, people will say, we need someone from the government to restore order, and they come in and collect everybody's guns, and yeah, they'll restore order, but when the dust settles, you'll fundamentally transform your country from the people ruling themselves from the bottom up to a king or a dictator ruling from the top down. Is this making sense?
It's making, not only is it making sense, but when people speak of the Hegelian dialectic, oftentimes they don't know what they're speaking of. When people talk about Saul Alinsky, they don't know the backstory. As a matter of fact, the information you provided was enlightening to me as well. So it's not only making sense, it's informational, and I love it. So the context here is so important, especially against the backdrop, against what's happening today. Go ahead and continue, sir.
And so we see this from the French Revolution to the Lenin's taking over of the Tsarist Russia, that it's, you want to create a crisis. Now, another definition that I'd like to bring up, communism is nothing more than monarchy. And you think, really? You'll think of it. Every communist country has a dictator, Stalin, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, Castro, Mao Zedong. And the communist party members are the new royalty. They get the nice houses and nice neighborhoods, and then the people are the subjects. Their fate's determined by the state. And socialism is nothing more than monarchy. You think, really? Well, Hitler was the head of the National Socialist Workers' Party. And also the Soviet Union is the USSR, Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And they all have dictators. And the students in college, well, they'll say, well, I thought communism and socialism is where everybody owns everything equally. Let's think a little deeper. Who decides who lives in the nice house and who lives in the dumpy house? Somebody in the government dictates those things. Well, whoever ultimately dictates those things is the dictator, right? And so when you have a centralized form of government, you think of it, the most communist country on the planet is what? Maybe North Korea. You know the actual name for the North Korean government? The Democratic People's Republic. It's not democratic. The people have no say. There's no representative republic. It's a dictatorship with the supreme leader, Kim Jong-un. And so the idea is we have to look at the function, not at the names, but we'll see that the spectrum of power, one side is total government, the other side is no government. Total government, you have a dictator who rules through fear. No government is anarchy. Unless, and this is where ancient Israel comes into the picture, no government's anarchy unless the people are taught a moral law. And so the priest's job in ancient Israel was to teach the population this moral law. But wait a second. What would motivate you to want to follow an internal moral law? Well, again, ancient Israel had the key ingredient, a God who is watching everyone. He wants you to be fair, and he's going to hold you accountable in the future. So you're about to steal, nobody's around, and then you think, God is watching me, he wants me to be fair, he's going to hold me accountable, maybe I should hesitate stealing. And it creates something in the back of your head called a conscience. So if everybody in the country believes this, you can maintain complete order with no policemen following anybody around. Maximum liberty. Now, it only works with the God of the Bible. An Islamic Allah God says there's an infidel woman there, nobody's around, you can rape her, it's okay. The God of the Bible says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So it's a complete system. One side is total government, the other side, people have these internal laws. It's sort of like everybody downloads a behavioral app on their iPhone. Instead of GPS telling them where to turn, it tells them how to act. But again, what would motivate someone to follow that is this concept that you're being watched by this God, and he wants you to be fair. He's going to hold you accountable. And so this is the idea that America's founders drew upon when they formed our government, and specifically Connecticut and Rhode Island and Massachusetts, these Puritan colonies where you had pastors and their congregations starting little communities. And then Connecticut became called the Constitution State. And then it was a blueprint for the bottom-up form of government that we have, where it's governed by the consent of the governed. But again, you look at history and you see where these attempts to rule without a king always end up falling. Why? Well, there's a loss of this consciousness of a God. There's a loss of internal morals. And then you have people yielding to their selfish side. And then you have more domestic chaos and smashing windows and setting buildings on fire and lawless mobs in the street. And then there's the call for some big, strong power to come in and take over. And again, when the dust settles, you'll have transitioned back to a king. And last year I was visiting with Ed Meese, the former attorney general under Ronald Reagan. And he was explaining that whenever, under the Obama administration, whenever there were riots and accusations of racism, that Obama's Department of Justice, Loretta Lynch, would have the federal government come in and investigate the sheriff's department. And the sheriff, instead of looking to report to the people who voted him in, now he's looking to possibly being accused of violating some federal crime. And again, a polarity change from the bottom up to the top down. And this was happening in city after city after city. And I think, in a sense, we may have been one major national crisis away from totally transitioning to a dictatorship. And I feel that Trump's election was a monkey wrench in their plans. But as you mentioned in the intro, that they still have their plans, and they're still trying to enact them behind the scenes, and it is a struggle for the very soul of the Republic.
Yes, it is. And our guest is Bill Federer. We got about a minute before the break. Bill, I want to ask you this. The founding fathers left us with many wonderful quotes. One of them is that the Constitution, and I don't have it verbatim here, but the Constitution is for a moral and religious people. Just in the last minute, why do you think that is the way that is?
Well, that's the John Adams quote, and even George Washington in his farewell address, he says that religion and morality are indispensable supports. And again, it goes back to Montesquieu, was a French political writer in 1748, wrote The Spirit of the Laws. He divided governments in three, republics, monarchs, despots. Republics, the people rule themselves, but the people need to have virtue. And he said this is most prevalent in Protestant countries of Northern Europe. He says monarchs, which is sort of like a king with strings attached, monarchs rule through honor and dishonor, and this is most prevalent in the Catholic countries of Southern Europe. But then Montesquieu goes on, he says despots rule through fear, and this is most prevalent in the Ottoman Empire, where the Turkish sultans will chop somebody's head off and so forth. And so for us as a republic to work, Montesquieu says the people need virtue. They need this internal morality. And so this is the idea that the people are the king. In one of my talks, I say, imagine visiting a king, and maybe in the Old Testament, and you're going through the streets of Jerusalem, and you're witnessing murder, rape, and crime, and then you get into the king's chamber, and he has his head in his hand, he's all worried, he looks up at you, and he says, did you see all that crime coming in here? I wish somebody would fix it. And you, like, reach over and tap him on the shoulder, say, excuse me, you're the king. You're the one that's accountable to God to fix it. That's like somebody in America watching TV, maybe even watching this show, and saying, you know, there's all these problems in the country. I wish somebody would fix it. Hello, reach through the TV tube or the screen and tap you on the shoulder. You're the king. You're the one accountable to God to fix this mess. Well, yeah. I need some.
And Bill, hold that thought. We're right up against the break. Our guest, Bill Federer, he is an author of American Minute. We're going to be right back with him after the short break. Don't go anywhere.
And welcome back to this edition of the Hagmann Report. Our guest, Bill Federer. This is a guy who I could spend a week with. I could sit down and have a cup of coffee with Bill Federer and just listen and just say, you know what, just talk. And because plus his library of the books he has written, it just unbelievable. Just a wealth of knowledge from who is the king in America. And who are the counselors to the king, to the history of Islam and such. In fact, I'm going to put a link to all of his books in the program description. You've got to take a look at this. Great gifts for Christmas, especially for those people interested in understanding what's taking place through the lens of history. And again, I could talk with Bill all day long. Before we get back to Bill, I want to mention that, speaking of gifts, give the gift of a box of steaks, or give it to yourself. You know, my wife, just loves to get Omaha steaks. OmahaSteaks.com is the place to go. Instead of going out in the snow, you know, when it's up to your hips, have your meat delivered to you, or have, if you can't think of a gift for that someone, that special someone, perhaps a boss even, this is a perfect gift for someone who has it all. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks and how. For under $50, for $49.99, you can get my family gift pack when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter our code HH in the search bar. Folks, that's 75% off. And they've got over 500 gourmet gift ideas. They've got great steak experiences at home. They offer the most flavorful tender aged beef. They've got seafood, poultry, pork, veal, lamb, and so many other gourmet items. You can spend all day long at omahasteaks.com. But again, don't forget to put HH in the search bar. Right now, Omaha Steaks is giving you, our listeners and viewers, an exclusive savings just to you. Listen to everything you'll get for under $50 very quickly. 2 filet mignons, 2 top sirloins, 2 boneless pork chops, 4 boneless chicken breasts, and they're fantastic. Everything's fantastic. 4 steak burgers, 4 potatoes au gratin, 4 caramel apple tartlets, which I know Eric the Tech and John, they fight over all the time, and I got to break them up. And, of course, the Omaha steak seasoning packet and 4 kielbasa sausages, plus you'll also get extra 4 free kielbasa sausages by ordering this pack. When you go to omahasteaks.com, enter our code HH in the search bar, you'll get a 75% savings. All of that for just $49.99. omahasteaks.com, HH in the search bar. You can't beat that. And that makes, again, it makes a great gift. Bill Federer is our guest. He's an amazing, amazing writer. And I highly recommend all of his books. We left off, and of course we're talking about his latest book, Who is the King in America? I think it's so prescient right now. And of course, let's continue with that, because you made some excellent points, and right up against the break, you got kind of cut off there. So if you want to continue with that thought going forward about, reaching through and tapping, hey, you're the king, you know, basically, you're the king. You can fix all of these issues.
Well, it is an interesting thought for someone to say, well, I need somebody to tell me what to do. Since when does the king sit on his throne and say, can somebody tell me what I'm supposed to do here? Hey, butler, come here. Cook, what am I supposed to do? No, it's your job to educate yourself on the issues, watch the Hagman Report and get educated. But then you need to seek the Lord, and you need to tell your representatives what needs to happen. You're the king. One of the other concepts that is important to understand is deconstruction. It's a communist tactic to basically take over a country. But it's a car goes from drive neutral into reverse. And so it's this idea you want to separate a people from their past, get them into a neutral where they do not remember where they came from. And then it's easy to brainwash them into the future you have planned for them, sort of a cultural DNA gene therapy thing. So if I was a toothpaste salesman, the first thing I would do is say negative things about the toothpaste you are currently using. You're still using that old stuff. Don't you know it'll eat the enamel off your teeth? Ooh, you're repulsed by it. Now I've got you into a neutral position. You're sort of open-minded. What are all the toothpaste out there nowadays? And then I can give you my pitch for this tartar control breath freshener stuff. So they go into the classrooms and they tell the students negative things about the founders of the country. They took land from Indians, sold people into slavery, and ooh, the students are repulsed by them. Now you got the kids into the neutral. They're sort of open-minded. What are all the belief systems out there nowadays? Then you can give them your pitch for socialism or LGBT or Islam. And so we see Europe went through this. Europe went from a Judeo-Christian past, right? Catholic cathedrals, Protestant Reformation, Jewish neighborhoods. And then Europe went into a secular neutral with the French Revolution and Napoleon spreading this French secularism all around Europe. And anything goes, right? Free sex and LGBT, all that agenda. But now Europe is entering an Islamic future with Mohammed being the number one name for newborns in London, Milan, and Brussels. And Europeans are scratching their head thinking, how did we get here? And so in that sense, the whole gay agenda is, in a certain perspective, simply a transition phase from the Judeo-Christian past to the Muslim future. It's not an end in itself. And we see this transition in the school system, where we've gone from Bibles in the schools to condoms in the schools, and now it's hijabs in the schools. We can look at China. When Mao Zedong took over in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, he had what's called a cultural revolution. What's that? He destroyed 5,000 years of Chinese culture, museums and artwork and libraries, and killed anybody that knew anything about the past, doctors, lawyers, teachers. If you wore glasses, they figured you could read. If you could read, you were educated, and they killed you. They killed 80 million people so that they had this mass of a billion uneducated young people that they could easily brainwash into the People's Republic of China. Pol Pot did the same thing in Cambodia. And so it's this idea where you want to criticize the past so that you can separate from it, and then you get into the neutral, and then you can take them into whatever future you have planned. So America's founders, for all their faults, they gave us a form of government where we're the king of our fate. And when they deride our founders and say, oh, they were terrible, the kids are like, oh, well, whatever they created must have been bad. Kids to say, well, the government should be providing everything for you, right? And I love the quote that Gerald Ford said. I read through all the messages of all the past presidents. I have to admit, the most recent past president I have not had the same amount of studying for. But the previous ones, I put together several books with all their quotes. And Gerald Ford, he must have mentioned it 50 times. The government that's big enough to give you everything you want is big enough to take away everything you have. And so it's this idea that you want to sell to the next generation. The government should take care of you, right? And they're like, oh, okay. Not realizing that once everything you get is from the government, they can decide who gets it and who takes it away. So that's the deconstruction concept I wanted to throw out. And another one is projection, psychological projection. If you'd like, I can share that one in a minute or two.
Sure. Yeah, and continue, please feel free. You've got the floor. Continue forward. Our guest is Bill Federer, very prolific author, a very articulate historian, and again, someone I could probably visit at his home and stay the week and just listen to him talk. So go ahead and continue, sir.
So an interesting tactic that's being used quite often is called psychological projection or blame shifting, where the attacker blames the victim. And Sigmund Freud is the one who coined the term where rude people project their rudeness onto others. And so hateful people call everybody else hateful. They'll even put up a website and list everyone that they hate. And so we see this is used in politics, where if a candidate has something that they're doing wrong, they want to accuse their opponent of the exact same thing. So maybe if you're doing a Uranium One deal, and you're giving away a large percentage of American uranium in exchange for donations of $145 million from wealthy Russians. What do you want to do? You want to accuse your opponent of the exact thing. David Axelrod was Obama's campaign manager, and he said on an NPR interview, 2010, he said, in Chicago politics, we have a tradition where you throw a brick through your own campaign office window and then call a press conference to accuse your opponent. In other words, you do the crooked thing and you blame your opponent for the exact same thing. What happens? The media looks at the opponent and the opponent has to spend all this time and energy trying to come clean. Meanwhile, his name is being associated with the accusation. And for a certain percentage of the public, name association is enough to figure if there's smoke, there's fire. And so they get a negative. And if it finally comes around to you pointing back at the other person, so wait a second, you're the one that's really done it. By this time, the public's worn out, and it's sort of a wash, and you think, they're all crooks, you don't know who to trust, and they get away with it. So, again, if you're a politician, you're running for office, and you get word that the other side's about to release some attack against you, you call a press conference and accuse your opponent of the exact same thing. It's important for us to understand these tactics, because they are being used every single day in the media. And one other book that, well, I've got several books, but one of them that is sort of fits into what we're talking about is this book, What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran. It's the history of Islam in the United States. And people say, well, what does that have to do? Well, we see a large amount of Muslim immigrants coming into Western Europe and coming into America. And we see that population dynamics are changing. And it's important for us to understand that there's lots of Muslims that just want to fit in, but there are some that have an agenda, and they think that they are following Muhammad's example. So the best Muslim that ever lived was Muhammad, and so his life is called the Sunnah, the way, the example. And so if we look at Muhammad's life, we get some very interesting insight into those that are trying to be like him. So Muhammad was born in 570 AD, and his father dies before he is born. His mother dies when he's 6 years old. His grandfather and guardian die when he's 8 years old. He's orphaned, taken in by an uncle, Abu Talib, who takes him on camel rides as a merchant. And then Muhammad begins to hear about the different religions and the different areas and begins to piece together his faith. And we see that he begins his faith officially in 610 AD. He goes to the city of Mecca, and he's wanting to make converts, and he only makes 70 converts in 12 years, and not very many. He begins to get confrontational, and the people of Mecca decide that he is a disturber of the peace, and they chase him out of town in the year 622 AD. Muhammad had tried to go to a city called Al-Ta'if. They didn't want him. They pelted him with rocks and stones, chased him out. Muhammad had nowhere to go. He was a Muslim refugee. So he goes 210 miles to the north to a Jewish city called Medina. The Jews are nice and tolerant, and they let Muhammad in as a Muslim immigrant. He goes into the minority neighborhoods in Medina, and he begins to organize a following amongst people who have grievances against the Jewish government of the city. And when we're familiar with the term of organizing in the community, when his following gets large enough, he and his followers pressure the Jews to accommodate him and the followers politically. The Jews do and make a treaty with Muhammad. So now Muhammad is a political leader in addition to being a religious leader. Now Muhammad's followers back in Mecca begin to get confrontational. They are chased out of town for disturbing the peace. They are Muslim refugees. And they go north to Medina, and the Jews let them in as Muslim immigrants. And Muhammad allows his followers to rob the caravans headed to Mecca in retaliation for the Meccans having chased them out of town. So where Jesus said, if they take your coat, give them your shirt, Muhammad's attitude was, if they take your house, you retaliate. Take their caravan. So he gets a whole chapter of the Quran, it's Surah 8, chapter 8, on how to distribute booty from robbing caravans. Muhammad gets a fifth of the booty personally. And so the Meccans send 1,000 soldiers to escort and protect their caravan, and Muhammad with 300 warriors defeats them at the Battle of Badra in 624 AD. This amazing victory, having been outnumbered 3-1, convinces Muhammad to be a military leader. And he fights in 66 battles and raids in the next 8 years before he dies. He even uses the catapult when he attacked the city of Al-Ta'if. And when they told him the catapult was hurling these rocks that were killing innocent women and children, Muhammad's response was, they are among them. So they got to be killed too. So suicide bombers and ISIS killers and San Bernardino killers and Orlando gay nightclub killers say it's all okay to kill innocent people to advance Islam because Muhammad did. And since he is those that want to be like him religiously, politically, and militarily. So within 5 years of Muhammad coming as an immigrant into the Jewish city of Medina, there is not a Jew left in the city of Medina. They were chased out, killed, or enslaved. Within 5 years of Muhammad's death, every pre-existing culture in Arabia was wiped out. In the next 50 years, the rightly guided caliphs and their armies conquered Jerusalem, which had been a Byzantine Christian city since Constantine, and then they conquer Syria. People forget Syria used to be completely Christian. Evangelized by the Apostle Paul, the name Christian was first used in Syria until Caliph Umar conquered it around 638. And then in 642 AD, Muslim leader Amir ibn Alas invades Egypt. Egypt used to be completely Christian, evangelized by Mark that wrote the Gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And then the Muslims conquered North Africa. People forget all of North Africa was Christian. There were 250 Catholic dioceses along North Africa. St. Augustine of Hippo was from Carthage. Today, that's Tunisia. But the Christians had embraced this pietism, this movement that said if you really become a Christian, you should give away your money and join a monastery or live in a cave. And so it was withdrawing from society. So as a consequence, in 10 years, the Muslims conquered all of North Africa. In the year 711, they crossed the Strait of Gibraltar and conquered Spain. So the Spaniards were still fighting on foot with heavy metal swords. Muslims were on Arabian horses with stirrups and scimitar swords. So in 10 years, they conquer all of Spain, carry away over 1 million into slavery. Then they cross the Pyrenees Mountains, conquer southern France, and they're finally stopped outside of Paris at the Battle of Tours in 732 AD, exactly 100 years after the death of Muhammad in 632 AD. So they go from Arabia to Paris in a 100-year military campaign. And since this is the first century of Islam, there are those in the Muslim world that look to this as their example. The same way Christians look to the first century of Christianity in the early church as their example. And so then another wave happened. The Turks convert to Islam. And they invade into what is today Turkey. Back then, Turkey used to be the Byzantine Christian Empire. All seven churches mentioned in the last book of the Bible were there all wiped out by the Ottoman Turks. And the letters in the New Testament to Ephesus and Colossae, Corinth, Philippi, all those cities were wiped out by the Muslim Turks. So the Greek Christians begged the Catholic West for help. The West sends help. It's called the Crusades. And they go for about two centuries and fizzle. And then the Muslims pick up where they left off. And in 1453, they conquer Constantinople. And why is this significant? Well, Constantinople was the capital of Europe. It was like the New York City where the East and West met. When the Muslims conquered it, it ended the land trade routes to get from Europe to India and China. Again, the year is when? 1453. So that's when the Western Europeans begin to look for a sea route to India and China. And in 1492, Columbus set sail. So think of it. Columbus would have never set sail over here if it had not been for an Islamic jihad over there. Columbus thought he made it to India, so he names the people he meets the Indians. Think of it. We never even would have called Native Americans Indians if it had not been for Islamic jihad, right? Because the Muslims had cut off the land routes to India. And so we see that they surround Vienna, Austria twice, and they begin to invade into Eastern Europe. And so there's this tradition in Islam that is religious and political and military. Now, over the years, they would go through stages of backsliding and become less violent, and that is something that we like. But in Islam, they have a concept. When your enemy is strong, retreat. When your enemy is weak, attack. Pretty simple. And so when the non-Muslim world would show itself strong by winning the Battle of Lepanto, Battle of Tours, Battle of Vienna, the Muslim world would retreat and lick their wounds and think, well, we'll still conquer the world for Allah, but it may have to wait till later. But when the non-Muslim world shows itself weak, they take this as a signal from Allah that they are supposed to attack. And as much as I hate to admit, it's sort of like the law of the jungle applied ideologically, that weakness invites aggression.
Okay, you just explained a part of history I don't think too many people really understand, and it's so important for, again, for the context of what we're seeing today. Wow, okay. You just covered a lot of ground, a lot of history, quite a few centuries there. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that amazing? Okay, wow.
To the political change as well. And if you want, I can sort of weave that
please
in.
Yes.
Yeah, we got about 5 minutes.
Yeah, this is fantastic. Go ahead.
So the great Ottoman Empire finally falls apart and after World War One, and you had Turkey had a leader named Ataturk, and he wanted to secularize Turkey. And he said, Mohammedism may have done for tribes in the desert. It's no good for a modern progressive state. And so he outlaws the fezes, the burqas. He outlaws the Arabic language. He has them dress in Western business suits and shave their faces. I mean, he moves the holy day from Friday to Saturday and Sunday because he wants to fit in with Western Europe. So Turkey's moving from 1924 to 1938. And then we have a leader of Egypt, Nasser. And you can see pictures of Cairo, Egypt in the 1960s and 70s. Looks like the Beach Boys, with the swimming suits. And then you look at the Shah of Iran. And he loved America. I actually met his son. And there's pictures of him with Eisenhower and Truman and Kennedy. And so the Muslim world was moving in a less fundamental direction and becoming more pro-West until two things happened. One was the Saud family had teamed up with the Wahhabi religion, which is the violent sect. Even Sir Lawrence of Arabia called it a puritanical, heretical sect of Islam that's very violent. Anyway, when the Sauds conquer Mecca in 1924, now the pilgrimages that Muslims take from around the world, they're getting infected with this Wahhabi version of Islam. But the big thing happened in 1938. That is when Standard Oil Company, you know him, John D. Rockefeller, richest man in the world, and all of the oil companies, and then he donates the land for the United Nations, Chase Manhattan Bank. The Standard Oil Company discovers oil in Saudi Arabia. And in one generation, Saudi Arabia goes from the poorest Muslim country to the richest Muslim country. And what do they do with their newfound wealth? They become a magnet for fundamentalism. And then they use their money to support fundamentalist groups that want to establish the fundamentalism, and they buy politicians with lots of money. And so they have lots of money to give. And so we see that from 1938, Saudi Arabia has been pushing this fundamentalist ideologically radicalizing effect. So 9 out of 10 mosques in America and in Europe and across Africa are financed by Saudi Arabia, and they're pushing this fundamentalist view. And so what happens is, when the if it would have left to itself, we would have had a more moderate Middle East, like the Shah and like Nasser and like Ataturk. But now, with the Saudi money funneling into these groups wanting to stir up, and now you mix it in with the globalist agenda, this idea that you need crises to allow people to be motivated to give up their freedoms, to have the crises solved. Now you've got people that are fundamentally and ideologically motivated coming into all these countries, ready to create crises, so that there can be this usurping of power even on a global scale. There's a whole lot more there, but we're running out of time.
Yes.
The book is called What Every American Needs to Know About the Quran, A History of Islam in the United States.
And I've got to tell you, that's a fantastic book in the context, again, provided. We just found our own official Hagman Professor of History and of Historical Context right here in Bill Federer. By the way, follow him on Twitter, at Bill Federer, on Twitter as well. And his book's available. Just a tremendous author and historian. The knowledge just before us, right in that hour, is just tremendous. Go ahead,
Bill. What's your favorite book that you've written out of all your books?
Well, I mean, I do like the George Washington Carver one. He was somebody from very disadvantaged backgrounds. Obviously, was born a slave, and he was raised by a white German couple that was childless, and he went to become a professor at Tuskegee for Booker T. Washington, who was a Republican. Booker T. Washington was the first black man to have dinner in the White House with Teddy Roosevelt. But George Washington Carver's attitude was, there's a problem. I'm going to go into my laboratory and seek ideas from God. And he created hundreds of uses for the peanut, revolutionized the economy of the South. So I tell people there's two ways of looking at the world. One is this entitlement view of, I need somebody to take care of me. The other is, no, you can come up with ideas to revolutionize the world. You can be the answer to the problems. And that's why I really like the Carver book. There's others. Okay. We're coming up with Christmas season. I did a book on the history of St. Nicholas and Christmas holiday traditions. That's a fun one. And then one I did with my wife called Miracles in American History. So there's stories from the Revolution. Fantastic.
And you did a great article, by the way, did Anti-Federalists Foresee Modern-Day Dictators. If you go to Bill Federer on Twitter, the link is there, as well as American Minute. But it's just fabulous. It's a great article. Bill, we're going to have you back, if you don't mind. We appreciate your insights and your knowledge and how articulate and how you laid all of this out for everyone to understand. It's just fantastic. We really appreciate your time tonight. We really do. Bill, that's Bill Federer and his
website, AmericanMinute.com. Also the host of a radio program, Faith in History, on the TCT Network. And going to have to check that out through Salem Radio Network.
Wow. Fantastic. Thanks, Bill. Somehow we got the audio kind of messed up there a little bit, so if we seemed a little bit disjointed, we apologize.
And we'll have to have him back on for sure.
Absolutely.
We only scratched the surface. And I want to read some of these books. They look very interesting.
Man, I got to tell you, the one in particular, Who is the King in America and Who are the Counselors to the King, seems to be so appropriate for the days in which we live currently. Give me right back. Stay right where you're at.